This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, a conversation with Lynn Stewart on her case and the crisis of American democracy. Good morning, Lynn. It's been wonderful having you in the San Francisco Bay Area, and it gives us a great opportunity to actually be on air with you for a full hour. Tell us what it's like being here.
Well, you know, I always say I'm going to the liberated zone of Berkeley, San Francisco, Marin County, and indeed, you know, this is my third trip here since I was arrested back in 2002, and it is wonderful. You know, I am so energized by all the good feeling and and I'm getting an instant replay of the joy that there was in New York on the day of our sentencing. The people's feelings, their joy at my good fortune at not facing the rest of my life in jail, although I must say as an innocent person, I'd like not to spend 1 minute in jail.
Right.
But being that as it may, it's just wonderful to see the good people out here.
Well, I think people have fully understood, Lynn, that targeting you is really an all-out assault on our democratic rights. After all, the enfolding of a courageous defense lawyer within the charges imputed to the client who is unjustly accused in the first place is an assault upon the entire process of rights to a defense, all of the elementary protections that we had a revolution to secure.
For those people who are just tuning in for the first time or who haven't heard our extensive series and followed the case of Lynn Stewart, let's give a little bit of the details. In April of 2002, the Justice Department accused Lynn Stewart of conspiring to commit terrorist acts, and also for violating the special administrative measures against her, that had been imposed on her client, Sheikh Omar Abdul Rahman, also known as the blind cleric, the blind sheikh, who had been convicted for in what was known as the Landmarks case. That is, Lynn, if you can explain.
Surely. In 1995, Sheikh Omar, who was always very maliciously pictured next to the smoking World Trade Center 1, even though he was never charged with that crime, never went on trial with the other men who did go on trial. Nonetheless, he is always, and it is, I would say, one of the largest mistakes out there, but one happily perpetuated by the media, including most recently an article in The New Yorker about the young man that's been charged with treason by the government, that he was indeed the perpetrator of the World Trade Center 1. Actually, he was placed in a frame-up case by someone that this program has certainly made great disclosure, let us say, about, and that's Imad Salem, a prime double agent working for the Egyptian government and the American government. You know, I'm not sure that's the right term. It's not a double agent because actually the Egyptians and the Americans work together.
Right.
But it wasn't always known to the Americans, I don't think, that he was working for the Egyptians. So in that sense, it was a double agent thing. And the sheikh was entrapped in this. He was entrapped by virtue of his duties as an Egyptian cleric, the way in which advice is given, and Imad Salem had his trusty briefcase with a recorder in it, and then the government proceeded, as they do in so many cases, to interpret this for the jury. When we wanted to interpret it on the defense case, the judge cut us off at the knees. He would not let us put on experts as to the terminology such as jihad. He would not let us put on experts to talk about the role of a sheikh within a religious community and how someone such as Sheikh Omar, who has a PhD from Al-Azhar, the equivalent of Oxford in our Western world, would be asked upon to give advice to tell people, you know, can I go and visit my mother-in-law if she is such and such, such and such, right up to, we have a great thing planned. And he would say, no, I don't think it's time for that. Or it's clearly a person who is dispensing advice to someone that he considered to be slightly mad when he's talking to Emad Salem. You can hear it in the tone of the voices. Come back to me again with that. That takes a lot of planning, you know. But I guess the U.S. attorneys are able to turn this and say, see, he didn't say, I'm going to the police station this minute. I'm going right down and report you for even asking me such a question. And by virtue of that, he's damned by faint praise, of course. So,
and in this case, the federal government created the picture of a demagogue. The
yes.
picture of the blind sheikh, the cleric who was the religious advisor at the mosque, and this was the new demagogue, the person who was creating the terrorists who were trying to bring down the World Trade Center 1, and then later on, the case that they brought to court, various landmarks throughout the New York region, when in fact, previously, it was the CIA, through Operation Cyclone, that was trying to recruit people from the mosques, and they did, particularly in Brooklyn. They were recruiting people and sending them to fight in Afghanistan to bring down the breakup of the Soviet Union using Afghanistan, the plan of Brzezinski of the Grand Chessboard of creating a Vietnam-like situation in Afghanistan, which led then to the breakup eventually of the Soviet Union and the creation of what is now the Central Asian Republics, and all to create and what they thought was going to be an easier avenue for accessing a pipeline from the Central Asian Republic oil down through access for the United States.
But here, after all, look, Lynn, I mean, the category of terror that's been invoked here, imputed first to the sheikh, and as you indicated with Emad Ali Salem, this is a design operation of the United States authorities from the get-go. The Federal Bureau of Investigation designed the plans, including the bombing of the World Trade Center, sent Emad Ali Salem into the mosque to set up the sheikh, to recruit young men. All of the plans are of his own authorship from the Federal Bureau of Investigation. He's wearing a wire. He makes transcripts of all of the set-up conversations, the sting operations in which he's engaged. They're in the FBI offices for 6 months, 50 file boxes of them. When, in fact, the event occurs, the bombing of the World Trade Center in 1993, Emad Ali Salem says, I was assured by my superiors that the explosives we supplied would not detonate. There is no ambiguity here. This is a government operation. The sheikh is being held up as a demonic other with which to terrorize the American people into submission, and then you are his defendant, his defender. The attorney who is defending a man accused of horrendous things when the state's hands are all over the events, a not uncommon occurrence in capitalist America, in which they pick someone who they can demonize, set them up for a crime that of their own authorship to create a climate in which repression can then occur. And that, to my way of thinking, Lynn, is the full meaning, impact, and significance of their targeting you. Because when the lawyer for the accused becomes enfolded within the crime of which the accused is put in jeopardy, then where is their due process? Where is there an adversary proceeding? Where is their right to a defense? And in this case, Lynn, after all, falsely accusing you of the crime that they've accused your client falsely of undertaking includes spying on every meeting you have, every conversation you have with your client. Who are the terrorists here? The state terrorists are destroying our civil liberties and our democratic rights, and they are intimidating and threatening every attorney in the United States who would be there for the falsely accused.
Ralph, I think you've hit it exactly. The accusation actually does fold me into the crime. And, of course, it's always interesting. And last night we were down in Fresno talking about this because these were people who really knew very little about the case at all, since we had never gone that far away from the center of life here. You know, I explained to them that in reality, the Sheikh's crime was really non-existent. He really was a question of a very bombastic, a very how would you say the Middle East rhetoric is so florid in terms of its accusation of anti-Americanism and its suggestions about the fields of jihad and the obligations of people to take up jihad, and the Sheikh, of course, was not an apologist. I think there are many people we can analogize him to in our own history. He certainly would have been a Patrick Henry, give me liberty or give me death. He basically says, you know, jihad of the pen. He says jihad of thought. He said, no, jihad is action. It is always action. They use these tapes to make him into a demon, and then they plugged in their interpretation. When my turn came, they played these same exact tapes, but now they said, you see, he's anti-American. You understand. He wants this country to fall. And Miss Stewart, her politics. Now, my politics couldn't be further from Islamists, as we all know. But my politics also have a distinct ring of, you know, if you can't do it right, you don't deserve to do it at all. That I look to a day of a revolution where the people and a socialist state will prevail, if not further to the left than that. And what they did was they equated his anti-Americanism with my anti-Americanism. You see, and that is very important because it's saying, you know, anyone who could possibly be supportive of a person like the Sheikh is automatically in his camp, carrying out his wishes, doing what he wants, when actually nothing could be further from the truth. I had no interest in his program. I had an interest in him as my client, and saving his life from what I now recognize was an early example of the kind of torture that they now are doing at Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, and to Jose Padilla.
Well, I want to address that, Lynn, but before, let me pose a question to you. This entire category of anti-Americanism, after all, we have a society in which 1% of the population owns more than 95% of the rest of the population combined. The fellow who wrote the book Up the Organization, Robert Townsend, who was the president of Avis and American Express, calculated that 5,000 people control what he called the commanding heights of the United States economy. He said they treat the country as their private whorehouse, and they look upon each president as their personal towel boy. Well, that's the I'm anti-American? We're talking about a struggle against an oligarchy that has usurped state power in the United States for a corrupt kleptocracy of the few, and those who oppose a system that violates our democratic rights are to be enfolded within a category of anti-American, or a sheikh who is opposing one of the most brutal dictatorships in the world, namely the Mubarak regime that tortures people at random and is run by the Central Intelligence Agency, to be an opponent of such a regime makes you an anti-American because the United States, along with the Zionist state, give more aid to Egypt than any other country except Israel, which is virtually the 51st state. Anti-American, we have to take our distance from these terms that are to define our reality.
Absolutely. It's a question of control by fear, by using this kind of device, and I believe it is a device, to say that people must be afraid of the state more than they must be afraid of what the state is doing to them. which is a big difference. You know, I mentioned at an earlier occasion, I can't remember when it was, but, you know, the lynchings were probably one of the earlier forms of this fear by example. They didn't lynch people because they had committed crimes. They lynched them as an example to others. And actually, in a certain sense, although the horror of that I wouldn't compare to, but, you know, people went to those lynchings enjoying them, writing postcards home. And in some sense, my conviction is like a public lynching. It's to warn everybody else, and particularly lawyers who have a frontline responsibility, not to defend too strongly. Don't be associated with your client. Well, hello, that's what it's all about. You've got to be associated with your client. Got to understand what makes them tick. Got to understand what you're defending against and why you're defending against it. So, you know, they have accomplished by my persecution, prosecution, a great many goals of theirs, not the least of which is, as you're saying, Ralph, to make sure that any kind of criticism of the government is equated to what they see as terrorism.
That's right. And just like to be opposed to the war in Iraq or previously the war in Vietnam or the attacks with the Contras in Nicaragua, the support of U.S. policy throughout the world to undermine liberation struggles, you're considered to be anti-patriotic, unpatriotic. You're anti-American. In fact, it's you are against imperial reach and you are for the rights of people. And I notice that even among people who defend, who support you, they still refer to the Islamic group, the group for which the Sheikh was a mentor, they refer to it as a terrorist group, when in fact the purpose of the Islamic group is a liberation struggle against the Mubarak regime. And you may not agree with the Islamic sensibilities of the group, but the main issue for the group is the repression and the repression of the regime against the group itself in every which way, whether it's a newspaper articles or imprisonment for speaking out. And this is the case that has been against the ANC in South Africa, against the Sandinistas, against all liberation struggles, against the Palestinian struggle throughout the years too. And it is to recreate these groups as terrorist groups, liberation
exactly.
groups, and then to come against the supporters mm-hmm. of the groups, people who support the liberation struggles, to make them terrorists too. And that's exactly what happened to you. And if you could describe something that I heard for the first time, which is how the prosecution, the government, the Justice Department played out the case in the courtroom with the big screen presentations in order to make the jury feel that they had no choice but to convict you.
Just to finish, though, your thought earlier, Maya, because I think it's crucial. You know, we as American left, yes, we serve a critical role of our own country and a critical role of what's going on abroad. But, you know, at the bottom line, there is a belief which we must have into self-determination. And although for me, I would not choose to live under an Islamic regime or theocracy, I don't think it's particularly healthy, I'm not about to say that other peoples coming from other cultures and belief systems don't have the right to follow their own history and make their own decisions. We can say, I think, fairly unequivocally that the only movements that have worked in the Middle East in recent time have basically been based on religion, whether we like that or we don't like that, whether we can ascribe that to the murder of the entire left by regimes unfriendly to the left. But still in all, this has been something which has galvanized the people. And as such, you're right, the Sheikh, and we had a witness ready to go in his trial that would say, we at the CIA knew the Sheikh was only about Egypt. He was not about coming to America and blowing up buildings. That was not his goal. His goal was to have a bully pulpit here, a fundraising place, a place where he could speak out and raise money. Very naive of him, exceptionally naive of him.
Well, you know, after all, Lynn, when we look at this clearly, in the aftermath of the Second World War, the abiding passion of the populations of the Arab East were for self-determination, to struggle against colonialism. And this was a national struggle, even a socialist struggle in every society. After all, even the regime of King Farouk was a secular regime. And the young officers who led the struggle against the Farouk monarchy, Nasser and Naguib, they were nationalists, and they were socialists of a sort, but they were national figures. The Ba'ath movement in Iraq and Syria was a socialist and a national movement, a secular movement, and the divisions between ethnic and religious components were largely minor and subordinated to the national struggle.
And the Palestinian struggle was a secular movement combining people of all religious groupings, and in Iran, the Mossadegh.
The national movement of Mossadegh and the struggle against the Shah. But one of the interesting things about this is that it's the Central Intelligence Agency and the Mossad that turned to the WAF, the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, right-wing religious fundamentalist groups, to arm and deploy them against the national and secular and socialist liberation regimes and anti-imperial and anti-colonial movements of the Arab East. Hamas was first funded by the Saudi monarchy and the Mossad. I was in Dahesh, the largest refugee camp in the West Bank, and a redoubt of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. Hamas was coming in there with Israeli support, targeting militants in the Palestine Liberation Organization struggles against Zionism and the occupation. The irony, and they did this in Iran as well, the Islamicists were deployed against the national and socialist struggles against the imperial puppets, the Shah of Iran, the Savak, and what have you. The irony of it, I think it's fair to say, is that in many of the locations here, such was the repression that the only place people could gather and even speak without arrest was the mosque. And like with the liberation theology outcome in Latin America, many of the mullahs were radicalized by the sentiment that was being expressed in the mosque of the oppressed and the disaffected and the rage of the population against the subjugation to which they were subjected, and the mullahs were taking on the radical sensibility of their constituents in the mosque. And now, here were the imperialists who had funded these people, like they'd sent these fundamentalists into Afghanistan to destabilize a Marxist government in Afghanistan that had done what? It had distributed land, it had removed the legal and religious impediments to women and their rights. And this was what was targeted by U.S. imperialism when it funded these fundamentalist operations to destabilize these regimes. Now, because of the fact that the basic dynamic is hunger and oppression and exploitation and subjugation, the very movement they funded has taken on the coloring and patina of the base of population. What is the abiding sentiment? Down with U.S. imperialism, down with our oppression and occupation and exploitation. So the basic underlying class content of all of this means that imperialism has to demonize anybody who is engaged in resistance to its designs. And now the people they used, they are deploying and abusing, but what is their constant? To justify imperial subjugation and to demonize any opposition as what? Communist, subversive, foreign agentry, or terrorism. Today, the lexicon is that of imputing terrorism to resistors, terrorism to those who oppose, terrorism to those who defend democratic rights, terrorism who want their national independence, their self-determination, they don't want their oil owned by the oil companies of a foreign power. Those who have those sentiments and who act on them are terrorists. We have to expose that the terror is state terror in the hands of that imperial cabal.
Hear, hear.
Lynn, please describe how the case unfolded in the courtroom, because the main aspect of it was to create a climate of terror and to fold you into it. One, having three
You mean a climate of fear.
A climate of fear, excuse me.
I like her formulation.
It was to terrorize the judge. Right, to terrorize the judge, to terrorize the jury, to set ground rules so that there was no way that you could even defend yourself in that situation.
Yes, it was. Well, we found out after the trial that indeed every case that the government brings that involves a terrorist charge, and, you know, I was charged with materially aiding terrorism under a tortured interpretation that by making a press release, I supplied personnel. And who was the personnel I supplied? That was my client I was supplying to a known terrorist organization. Actually, the press release was made to Reuters, not on the terrorist list yet that I know of, but they claimed, of course, that it was really a communique.
And part of your material aid was yourself and your telephone and your legal representation.
That I was his lawyer was the conduit. But what they did, and we found out later that indeed U.S. attorneys in all districts have been told that if you're trying a terrorism case, you have to get bin Laden into the case.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever it is. If you're doing Palestinians who contributed to Hamas 25 years ago, somehow or other you've got to get bin Laden in front of the jury. Because bin Laden has become the boogeyman, the guy who they have set up to be to get visceral reaction to. And so as a result, they put him in every case. And in our case, what they did was they had searched my two co-defendants' homes and taken out boxes of material. It's not to belabor the point. These materials were all legitimate in the sense that they were clippings and videos and tapes and what have you. You know, as activists, we tend to collect this stuff. We have it. My one co-defendant was working on his PhD for the Sheikh, suggested by his chairman at NYU because he had this tremendous access to a person who had been on center stage in the world, and no one else would have that access. So he was working on his PhD. He had everything possible about the Sheikh in his study, books, papers, etc. He even had the Sheikh's doctoral dissertation, which I understand is rather heavy going. But anyhow, my other co-defendant, Ahmed Sattar, was an active leader. He was extremely active in the mosques. He had a lot of material that had been taken from the Sheikh's, end quote, mosque in Brooklyn when the new regime, handpicked by the Egyptian government, took over there against the wishes of the congregation, who were basically powerless to stop the fellow. But he removed all that stuff and put it in his garage. When they came to search his garage, they seized it. So then they had, you know, they had all sorts of really salacious material. By that I mean, you know, they had the Protocols of Zion were there, introduced into evidence against Mr. Sattar, state of mind. And they had tapes of bin Laden. Because some of the things that were done, there was like a conference and bin Laden appeared and they were championing the Sheikh and free the Sheikh, he's an innocent man imprisoned. And Sattar had this tape. Of course he would have this tape. He's an Egyptian naturalized citizen who has done work among his own and who is talking to everyone on the internet, which
and
was his downfall.
There is no law about having a library, about having information. We still have the Bill of Rights and the right of free speech.
Well, wait till they come for the files of Taking Aim. I mean, what have we been doing? We've been gathering the material to show that Osama bin Laden was paid $6 billion by the Central Intelligence Agency, sent into Afghanistan, organized by the CIA and by the ISI.
Ralph, you need a good lawyer.
We've got one. And then, I mean, irony of ironies, you know, Osama bin Laden is no more responsible for the attacks on the World Trade Center than the Pope. The Pope is closer to the United States who, authorities who carried out the event than Osama. But the reality is that Osama bin Laden from his cave in Afghanistan had vanishingly little to do with any of these events and has so proclaimed in meticulously argued discussions and interviews. I mentioned this in the Pakistani publication Umat. So what you have here is like Sacco and Vanzetti. Here are anarchist, working-class immigrants, Italian immigrants, who are falsely accused of what was clearly a state crime in order to create a climate of fear and to impute to those who oppose exploitation by capitalist America with crimes against the state. This is as old as the ruling class in its power, and the ideology of the category of terror is deployed to create the police state that is in advanced process now, after all. What more important than to attempt to destroy the right of lawyers to defend the accused, which is why push comes to shove, the case that has been mobilized by the psalm-singing Ashcroft against Lynn Stewart is really the unfolding of the architecture of the fascist state in America.
This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, a conversation with Lynn Stewart on her case and the crisis of American democracy. Lynn?
As we were talking about when we broke for the station break, the government paraded out bin Laden. They also paraded out newspaper articles. Michael Tiger, my lawyer, said, "Judge, this is the first trial by newspaper I ever saw in my life," because they had all sorts of articles that had been written about, quote, terrorist acts. Some of them had been supplied to me as part of the discovery in other cases, notably Nasser Ahmed, who was held on secret evidence and who we went before an immigration judge and eventually not only threw out the fact that there was no secret evidence, it was all innuendo and rumor, but eventually got him the amnesty so that he could enter the United States, and he is alive and well and has a large family in New Jersey.
This is one of your previous cases.
One of my previous cases. And of course, he was the Sheikh's paralegal during the trial. But in my case, they just trotted out this stuff, and it was all intoned endlessly. This is not introduced for the truth of the matter. It is introduced only as to state of mind, implying that if you had an article that talked about some group somewhere doing something, then you indeed had a, quote, terrorist state of mind. No matter what the answer was to why you had that, whether you knew of having that article, whether it was shoved in a dusty file, whether it was supplied to you by the government or not. And the images, though, of bin Laden, which I think is the most significant. These were images, you have to understand. It wasn't just a little snapshot that was passed around to the jury. These were images that were projected on a screen, and this screen was at least 20 feet high and 15 feet wide, and these images showing bin Laden at conferences, bin Laden in Pakistan during the anti-Afghanistani war, the anti-Soviet war in Afghanistan, I should say. These were projected in that courtroom, this courtroom not 10 blocks from Ground Zero, a jury of persons who each, I'm sure, had their own story of where were you on 9/11, what happened to you that day, what were you feeling, and here to have this projected after the judge had promised them there was nothing about bin Laden in the case, bin Laden had nothing to do with this case. He kept repeating this during the trial, but of course, as you know, our human nature, our brains, you can't put a picture of Hitler in a synagogue and say to people, don't look at that. That has nothing to do with what's
going
on.
Well, to get an emotional response.
To get the emotional response.
And then it's very difficult to separate the intellectual information, the facts of the case, from what has been day after day, hour after hour, brought in as an emotional response.
Well, it's the Reichstag fire syndrome. I mean, after all, Lynn, the prosecutor here, Patrick Fitzgerald, was also the prosecutor of the sheikh, and he was the prosecutor of the putative agents of the blowing up of the U.S. embassies in Nairobi and Dar es Salaam. The evidence about that being a United States intelligence job is massive and overwhelming. It's been amplified by the San Francisco Chronicle. The figure involved was trained at Fort Bragg, worked for the Central Intelligence Agency and the Federal Bureau of Investigation, was even sent in to arrange bodyguards for Osama bin Laden. Patrick Fitzgerald, after all, who is your prosecutor, as he was that of the sheikh, is deeply involved in the government's own role in all of these events. So when you really come down to it, these are instruments of the state amplifying a state campaign to demonize all who resist and to attack the right to an attorney and to terrorize attorneys, talking about terror. After all, if an attorney can be threatened with 30 years imprisonment for defending a falsely accused person in the United States, this is really the preparation for a police state in America. And that's why I think, after all, what your case represents is the struggle against the fascistization of our society, heart and soul. And you mentioned something before, Lynn, that I'd like you to amplify, and that is to say your realization now that, in fact, the sheikh, like Jose Padilla, has been, in fact, tortured. There was an article on the 23rd of February in The Guardian. The U.S. psychological torture system is finally on trial. It was referencing the case of Jose Padilla. Well, this torture system is longstanding, as any student of the American prison system knows. It's the sensory deprivation and the MKUltra torment of people, is standard procedure in U.S. maximum prisons and the criminalization of poverty. But here it is exposed in the case of Padilla as a standard procedure. The torture state is what it is that's targeting you, and your client was no less subject to this, it seems, than others.
I couldn't agree with you more, Ralph, and I actually was reminded when I was down in Palo Alto by Mr. Minkler, who is a poster maker, that he had done a poster 10 years ago about the Lexington Control Unit that was originally proposed for women prisoners. And this was in Lexington, Kentucky, and they put two ex-members of the Weather Underground, one Sylvia Baraldini, who has since been repatriated to Italy, Alejandrina Torres from the Puerto Rican movement, and they locked them in a box underground. And it was 24 hours of light. They started disintegrating. They have told me, you know, things like they would see bugs all over, even though there were no bugs there. This is what the human mind, sleep deprivation. At any rate, they went to court and they beat back that particular. They had a very good judge. They were very lucky. And so that came to it. But it existed. And it's just interesting. It's the same methods. I think that we did not fully appreciate the extent of the torture. We were aware of the isolation of the sheikh, that he was, you know, allowed no visitors whatsoever, not even an imam, no one to come in to speak to him at all, except blood relatives, who, of course, the Mubarak regime would not give visas to. So, of course, he had no visitors on that level at all. He had one phone call a month to his wife for 10 minutes. This is a man that lived on the phone. As a blind man, the phone was his window. He could speak with anyone. When he was in jail in New York, pre-trial, they allowed him to make endless phone calls. He even preached at the mosque over the telephone. But now he was completely cut off. One call to his lawyers once a week.
And he's also cut off from the prison guards themselves because they speak English.
Exactly. And he was also directed, and they were directed not to speak to him. Do not engage.
Total isolation.
The techniques that have been deployed on a constant basis now, it's at least a half century that the United States authorities have done this to prisoners and to victim populations across the world. Wherever people are incarcerated now, they subject them to sensory deprivation. No light, no sound, and total isolation. And then heavy administration of mind-altering drugs from LSD to other mind-altering substances, and then bombarding people with enormous amounts of noise, so that, in fact, the human organism breaks down. In the case of Padilla, he is no longer able to distinguish his defenders and his lawyers from his persecutors. It's ingrained in him that he speaks about anything that he will be subject to more torture. He is unable to distinguish friend from foe. We're talking about hours and days and weeks of total sensory deprivation, of mind-altering drugs, of constant assault, where his ability to discriminate is gone.
And in light of the torture of your client and his deteriorating situation, his health and his deteriorating state of mind, which you noticed, your goal was to get him out of the United States.
To get him out was our only objective that we had left. We actually, 2 days before 9/11, his family had been contacted by officials in Afghanistan. If you remember back to those days, they were holding three Christian ministers that they said were in their country preaching against Afghanistan, and they were going to put them on trial. But they thought, maybe we can work out an exchange here. And of course, you folks and us who have lived through the, quote, Cold War can remember one Russian walking across the bridge and one American walking in the opposite direction. So Ramsey Clark was about to go to Washington to talk to the State Department about the possibility of this exchange, which we didn't have high hopes for. The United States government really had a completely this was not some innocent that had been picked up in the sense that he had no politics. They were no more inclined, I think, to place the Sheikh in Afghanistan than the. But still, we were following up. This was part of our work as his lawyers. And, you know, I just did want to follow up on the Padilla because, you know, we talk about the chill effect on lawyers and that it has a real effect and that people are not able to defend in the same way. But this is the proof that, you know, there is always a striving. There is always people that will not play by their rules. They clearly did not want this to come out about the torture. They clearly, if these lawyers had been any less, aggressive, it would have remained a sealed item. It would have maybe never been brought out. But they elected to make this motion, and it's not just the client is psychologically unable to stand trial. This is he will never be able to stand trial. He has been destroyed in such a way as a human being by the people who seek to punish him that he can never stand trial, and the case must be dismissed. This is a different aspect because in the law, if you find someone psychologically unfit, then the government will make him fit. I don't want to think about what that might mean in Mr. Padilla's case. But at any rate, the lawyers who brought this out and who circumvented the sealing order by virtue of making these exhibits to their motions, which are part of the public record, and thus revealing what is going on, have really asking for trouble, maybe. I don't have to say it, but it would appear that that's what happens.
And it's in these days that the prison guards who administer the torture, they actually have some of them who have agreed to come forward.
Lynn, what you're describing with respect to Padilla, Jose Padilla is an American citizen. The category of enemy combatant and his military commissions acts and the destruction of habeas corpus and the Attorney General's declaration that habeas corpus is in no way guaranteed by the United States Constitution sets the stage for rounding up anybody under these categories without the right to an attorney. And attorneys who disclose what's happened to their clients are subject to the same treatment. That, I again say, when Ashcroft and the authorities targeted you, their targeting of you is a signal event It's an assault on the rights of every citizen in this country, and it's an ominous threat to any attorney in the United States that if they dare to defend those falsely accused, those persecuted by the state, count their days as being amongst those who will be subject to the same treatment.
And, Ralph, we have to remember that he announced it on the David Letterman show. Very unusual way to he was rallying the mass of America before you had even received an indictment.
Exactly. And Ralph described him as a psalm singer. Would that he were a psalm singer. Instead, he has this horrible song about the American eagle that
right.
I think he wrote.
Yes, he did write.
Which has a line, you know, there shall be no king but God. This is not my America. We don't have any kings.
Right.
And God, I thought, was a matter of personal choice, whether you believed or didn't believe, but not in Ashcroft's outlook. And I keep saying, where is John Ashcroft?
Well, I do remember that he ran against a dead man and lost.
Yes.
After all, if that doesn't tell you something about the composition.
Well, he's been replaced by Alberto Gonzalez,
right,
who has rationalized torture.
Rationalized torture is now blaming the lawyers for Guantanamo, saying the trials are held up because those pesky lawyers are making so many motions and making so much legal work. Of course, the fact that they kept these people from lawyers at all for 3 years, he has no appreciation of the process. He doesn't care about it. He wants the end result only. And this is what has been so characteristic, that the process is innovative.
Ralph, can I say something first?
Yes.
Because in your case, where they riled up the jury, they essentially made it so that they had no choice. And still some jurors held out. They pressured those jurors for that guilty conviction. It really seems to me, especially when the jurors came forward after the trial, to say that they were pressured into that conviction. And still, Judge Kirtle, when it came time for the sentencing, despite the government insisting on a 30-year maximum sentence, what he did is he looked to your life as an attorney, and he stated, for over 30 years, she has practiced law, concentrating on criminal law. In the course of that practice, while she has become well-known and celebrated as an excellent lawyer, she did not use the practice of law to earn personal wealth. She represented the poor, the disadvantaged, and the unpopular, often as a court-appointed attorney. Indeed, she was appointed by the court to represent Sheikh Omar Abdulrahman, and thus it was through initially responding to a call for representation of a very unpopular client that she became involved in the crimes of conviction. Having spent her professional career often representing the poor, she is now at the end of her career financially destitute. By providing a criminal defense to the poor, the disadvantaged, and unpopular over 3 decades, it is no exaggeration to say that Ms. Stewart performed a public service, not only to her clients, but to the nation. Criminal defense lawyers are an essential part of the administration of justice, and without them, a fair and just system and the guarantee of the Sixth Amendment could not exist. And yet, here we have, after this, when he noted what you had contributed, and he balanced that against what he believed in this conviction. After all, he set the stage in that courtroom for this conviction. But he responded to the outpouring of support, the more than 1,000 letters from the people whom you defended, people who had been in the very Justice Department itself, lawyers, judges. He responded, and he saw, he came to those terms, and he gave you a sentence of 28 months. And yet, what does the Gonzales Justice Department do? They turn around, and they insist, they go to the appellate court, they insist they must have their 30 years. Material aid to terrorism, this is setting the stage to prevent anyone from having representation. It is so clear what they are doing here.
They are absolutely showing their true colors, which is that this is not about punishing someone for breaking a prison regulation. This is a much broader thing. This is sent out to warn the entire bar that you can't go beyond what we tell you are the limits. That's what's so crucial here. Those SAMs were limits. They were set on the lawyer and the lawyering. They have taken away our ability to make decisions for our clients, with the client, without the interference of the government.
And it's saying also to each and every one of us who resists, who fights for liberation, who struggles, they're saying that when the government comes down, when the heavy hand of government comes down upon you, there will not be someone there to defend you against the state.
Exactly.
You know, when Fidel Castro was on trial for the Moncada raid, the judge of the time, Manuel Urrutia, after the speech by Fidel Castro, "History will absolve me," refused to convict him. And in fact, under that system, Manuel Urrutia then withdrew as judge, and he was the designated first president of Cuba by the July 26 movement. And I mention this because let's be clear about what we're addressing here, Lynn. Targeting you, and now with their demand that you in fact receive 30 years imprisonment, we're looking here at treason at the top. We're looking here at a criminal ruling class that wants to destroy all of the gains for which people have struggled for centuries. And that's why you're in the cockpit of and the target of this regime, because you are an instrument of resistance to the tyranny of this criminal ruling class. I say it without any hesitation. They are capable of doing anything. They will not stop at anything. Your defense is a vital element of our survival in this society. It's incumbent upon everyone listening to us, everybody who hears you, to get involved in mobilizing in your defense, because they are not done with this persecution, and they are a ruthless bunch. And I have no reluctance in saying that we are not going to be able to persuade these people or to influence these people or to reform these people or to change these people. We're going to have to overthrow these people, and that requires mobilizing our base, the mass of our people, to defend our rights and to take power from this handful of criminals who are targeting all those who have defended justice. A person like yourself, a lifetime of defending the oppressed, becomes the criminal. And what does that say about the state? That it is the state itself which is the ultimate criminal in this matter. So I fear for what the appellate court will be subjected to here. Then, I know that only the resistance that we mobilize in our streets and amongst the many who understand what's at stake can defend your freedom and our own. And we have to be clear about what's at stake here in the case of Lynn Stewart. It's our right to survive in this society, brothers and sisters.
Lynn, could you tell us what is going to happen in the next few months and what is the schedule and how people can assist?
The case is on appeal. That means it will eventually be heard by a 3-judge panel in New York City in the Second Circuit, a very prestigious court and a very conservative court also. They will review any errors at the trial. They will review the admission into evidence of these pictures of bin Laden. They will review the intrusion on the attorney-client privilege. All of the issues that were raised below will be re-argued. It will be the additional argument by the government, as Ralph has indicated, that 2.5 years for a 68-year-old cancer survivor is not enough. We have to give her 30 years. We have to give her a life sentence. She has to die in jail. And they will be arguing that as well. The case works this way. Everybody submits their briefs on a certain date. We are pushing that date forward because it is a massive case. There have been some new lawyers that have come in on behalf of other defendants. So that date will be pushed forward. And I would hazard a guess that at some time in the fall, briefs on behalf of the defense and the one brief on behalf of the government will be submitted. Then we have a chance to answer the briefs. In other words, they will answer our arguments, we will answer their arguments, and then eventually a date will be given for oral argument. You know, it's funny, we were riding in the car the other day with Michael Ratner from the Center of Constitutional Rights, also doing this tour, and he turned around and he said, well, what are you going to ask people to do, Lynn? And, you know, it's an interesting thing, and the only answer I can say is agitate. Agitate, agitate. Old Joe Hill, a fellow Swede who came to a sorry end, unfortunately, at the hands of the state, you know, don't mourn me, organize. Let's get out there. Let's keep this agitation going. Because the judge, yes, he did stand up. He was buttressed by the opinion of 1,000 Americans who were not afraid to sign their names, to recount who I was to them. But, you know, it's also the force of change around us that influences these judges. You can say, oh, they're judges, they're removed. They're not removed. They're people, too. They're part of the society. And if we can demonstrate that this is a great groundswell and part of it is the repugnance at what has happened to me, that is what is important. So people should be talking and organizing. Get onto my website, lynnstewart.org. You can get videos. You can get CDs, DVDs. See, I'm giving up my age when I say videos, right? but we have some wonderful material. I'm happy to come and speak. If someone can arrange a speaking engagement, I can usually get permission to go. That's what I'm doing out here is re-injecting the notion that we can't just rest on any kind of, I can't even say rest on our laurels. We don't even have any laurels. We have Heartbreak Hotel up in the Congress, and we need to keep working on this.
That's www.lynn, L-Y-N-N-E, Stewart, stewart.org. And people can contribute money for the defense. This is a group of attorneys, and they do it for love, but they also, there are many expenses in the appellate process.
And they actually have to eat as well.
Oh,
that's www.lynnstewart, LynnStewart.org. This has been Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, a conversation with Lynn Stewart on her case and the crisis of American democracy. It will be available on our website, www.takingaimradio.com, and on the WBAI archive, www.wbai.org. We'll be with you next week. Big in the eye.